You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Allison O'Daniel. Allison, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's see, you're in LA now, right? And what is it that you're working on at the moment? Or if you can tell us a little bit about what's happening in your studio, and then maybe we can talk about other projects that you're doing.
Sure. It's funny. I just had a very Los Angeles moment. I was racing home through crazy traffic from Compton, from Centennial High School in Compton, where I'm working with a marching band, the Centennial High School Marching Band. And they are in a film, a very long form project that I'm working on that expands across a whole bunch of different media. But ultimately, it started out as a film project, and it all comes from a script that was based on three musical scores. And so the project is called The Tuba Thieves, and it is a project that began when I heard a news story on the radio about these tubas that were stolen from a high school in Los Angeles. And I thought that was an interesting story, and then the next week I heard another report on the news about this, and then I heard another, and then I heard another, and so I started to investigate this story.
But wait a minute, these multiple news reports, these are for the, it's not for the same story. You're saying tubas are being stolen in different places.
They were being stolen from high schools and middle schools all across the greater Los Angeles area. And it was a phenomenon that occurred over predominantly over about a 2.5 year period, pretty intensely. It was there were a lot of news reports being done about it, and it was, lots of band directors were talking about it, and it was just this rash of theft that happened for this kind of long period of time. And I started tracking it. I just started keeping track of the high schools and how many tubas were stolen and who was reporting on it. And my interest in the story came from the fact that I had just, in 2011, on November 2011, I had just premiered my first film called Night Sky in New York at the Anthology Film Archives with Art in General. And I premiered that film, and I had just finished this very long process in that film where I made the film with cast and crews that were half deaf and hard of hearing and then half hearing. And when I say half and half, that's not a really good breakdown, because really everybody working on the film, for the most part, in all the significant roles, were had some relationship to sound, either as experimental musicians or as actors who are deaf or as sign language interpreters. And so I premiered this film, and I had presented two presentations of the film with live accompaniment. And so one version was with live musical accompaniment, and one version was with live sign language accompaniment. And when I worked with the sign language interpreter, we worked with a bunch of deaf artists and performers to really develop a very nuanced sign language accompaniment that was meant for the deaf audience and wasn't about trying to translate the sound of the auditory performance into sign language, but rather letting them be their own independent thing. So I was very sensitive to these stories of sound, and the way that the stories of these tuba thefts was being reported was very much about the thieves. And so I had all these questions. I wanted to know about the students in band class who no longer had tubas to play, and I wanted to know how it was affecting the communities. And so basically from this experience of these tubas being stolen in Los Angeles, I decided from that, I kind of made this leap that I wanted to make a new film and start with the music and switch around the process of adding the music afterwards, but instead I wanted to get composers to make me music and give them things to think about and consider, such as the fact that these tubas were being stolen, or even very random things such as an artist who I really liked. For example, I was looking at Sophie Tauber Arp's work, and I wanted one of the musicians to consider her work as a potential score to work from, or architecture, or there were different things that I gave these composers to work from, and then I built a screenplay from listening to their music and really let the music guide me. And I've been on this long path since that started of really dissecting what filmmaking can be and what narrative can be and how narrative can be explored and told and shown and how it can develop through working with the bands, the students, and then working with different performers and musicians whose relationship to music is maybe a little bit unconventional or interesting or unique and individual in its own way. And I've set out to kind of learn about those individual ways and then be affected by them. So
it's fascinating, and it seems like such an unusual approach to the film. Let's talk a little bit more about how this film about the tubas is evolving. I mean, you know, you're talking to me about letting the music kind of guide how you're constructing it, which isn't totally clear to me, but maybe you can just talk about how the film is coming together. It's a fascinating project, but also an incredible story, like where are all these tubas?
Well, and interestingly, the tuba thefts is not the entire story of the film. The film is called The Tuba Thieves, but it never really revolves around the actual thefts. We did film a restaging of the thefts based on some of the stories that the band directors told me, but there's many other sort of stories that come about. Like, we did a recreation of so to answer your question more directly, there are segments of the screenplay that we have already filmed, and so some sections exist and have already been edited and have already been screened and shown in gallery exhibitions as installations, and then some stuff exists only on paper in a more conventional screenplay format. And there's multiple reasons for this. Partially, I'm really interested in the sort of dominant structure of filmmaking, especially living out here and having worked with so many people who work in the film industry. But I'm an artist, and I come at this from a position of being an artist and also having a background in choreography. I was a figure skater when I was a child. And then the thing that's influenced me the most is that I'm hard of hearing. I'm partially deaf, and I wear hearing aids, and I lip read, and I've been working with all of these people who have really different experiences of sound. And when I was in my 20s, I just sort of started to really understand that this experience that I've had my whole life, which evolves with developing technology. I mean, every time I get a new pair of hearing aids, my sound world is radically different. And but in my 20s, I sort of started to realize that, I had very real frustrations and experiences that were difficult, but I had been raised with this relationship to my hearing, like, oh, no big deal in some ways. Like, you've got hearing aids and you don't have a speech impediment and you're fine. And, that was sort of the world that I grew up in. And then in my 20s, I started to realize, actually, this has affected so many things in my life. There's this kind of level of constant frustration and aggravation that's just here, and what is it and why is it here? And as I started to ask those questions, I started to also kind of open up this really profound recognition that sound had also been guiding me for a really long time, and my relationship to sound, this kind of stilted and distant relationship to sound, started to become really interesting to me as a medium in and of itself to work with. And I think what I've kind of set out to do is take all of these formats that exist, such as filmmaking or more material relationships to object making or sculpture, and to really approach them from a perspective of this kind of hard of hearing relationship to sound or to other things. And what I mean by that is that I am pretty conscientiously inserting pauses and delays, and the process and act of listening, a very engaged relationship with that, I'm inserting it into the process of filmmaking. So everything kind of slows down and stretches out, and authorship is, you know, the door to how that is defined in the making of this project is wide open as a way to put at the kind of foundation what this question, what does it mean to listen, and what does it mean to hear, whether that is with ears or through an entirely different process. Does that make sense at all? Or
it makes a lot of sense to me. No, and I'm really glad you spelled it out like that, because it does challenge what it means for all of us, you know, to hear, to listen. I had a very good friend, and maybe this is a little off topic, but similar. She grew up with parents who couldn't hear, but she could, and she said that. Which is, of course, a different situation. Her parents couldn't hear sound, but she said that, and this may be just completely different than your situation. She was talking about how hard it is for other people to understand what it is for people who are entirely deaf experienced. And she said there's a lot of things they couldn't understand, that their language is a language of symbols, and that there was a whole world that was kind of abstract to them. And she began doing, I don't know, all kinds of adult things at a young age. And to me, it was just, the more she talked about it, the more I realized how difficult it is to understand. I don't know whether it's a cognitive thing or what, but this idea of a kind of new way of what it means to hear differently, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there are so many interesting explorations of this from, I feel like every other week I'm hearing something on Radiolab where they're talking about deafness, which is so wonderfully ironic that it's a radio program. And what about the whole population of deaf people who, you know, what is their relationship to these radio programs that are being produced, or even, you know, us doing this? What does that mean for all of my deaf friends and collaborators, for me to do an interview that's only spoken and only through sound? You know, it is fascinating. There is this entirely different world, and for all of the collaborations that I've done with not only, you know, people who have quote-unquote perfect hearing and are experimenting with kind of, you know, pushing sound into these boundaryless spaces as experimental musicians, or even just people who become interested in sound art, to these people who, you know, maybe are completely insulated in the deaf community that I've become acquainted with, who, you know, don't even know much about art, also to other artists who are deaf and hard of hearing that I've been working with. So it's fascinating. It's an amazingly beautiful world that's opened up my relationship to my own experience of sound, and also all these other people's very specific relationships to sound. So.
And let's talk about how it's all presented. Ideally, the project with the tubas or anything else, how will that actually be presented? How will the viewing public perceive this project?
Yeah, it's I don't know exactly how the hearing public perceives it, but I know that one thing that's really important to me is that I'm constantly presenting sculptural work that has no sound element. And what I want the audience to understand is that it is work that you're looking at that is using different sensory modes, but everything about it comes from a process of listening to specifically to this music that I commissioned. And so there's this element that's removed. You know, I'm not allowing access to the sound aspect when it's sculptural work. And I want there to be a consideration when the hearing audience or any audience looks at it that, oh, these decisions were made based on a process of listening, and for there to be some sort of engagement with the fact that music is not there in that moment. And then also, you know, I screen segments of the film, which it's been written as a feature-length film, but I'm filming segments of it both for monetary reasons and also for conceptual reasons, because this process is really interesting to me. But I will present film installations and do these very specific edits of these scenes of the film for a gallery or whatever format that it's shown in, and then there will be a different edit that exists at the end. And then also, like, this coming Thursday night at the Art Los Angeles Contemporary Fair, the Centennial High School Marching Band is going to perform. And what we're thinking about in a lot of different ways, but one of the things I've been thinking about is, you know, I was very adamant that I didn't want them to be like art fair entertainment. That's not at all the way that I think about working with these students. I want them to have agency and authorship and to not, you know, be there as this thing for the people coming into the fair, but rather to work with all of these aspects of the fair, like the, just the din of noise that will be produced from all of these people at the opening. Also, just the way that art fairs are, you know, bifurcated into these strange booth-like spaces and the sonic quality of the fair and the bespoke tent. You know, I want all of that to kind of be laid out almost as a musical score to be read to these students. And so I just was at their class rehearsal, and they actually did a Pauline Oliveros piece, which is amazing. It's been really fun to teach these students about John Cage and about Pauline Oliveros. And so they're going to be performing this Pauline Oliveros piece, and then they're going to perform an Eminem song.
That's great.
Yeah,
what,
it's fantastic.
Who's in the band? Like, how many kids are there?
There are 37 students in the band, and then there will also be, I think, 7 majorettes. So the it's not quite the step team. They have, you know, batons, but in this environment, they're not going to be using the batons because of, I mean, and they're not going to be, like, throwing the batons around, basically. It's going to be more controlled because there is this sensitivity to the fact that there is artwork around and that there are people who, you know, they don't want. There are galleries who don't want a performance going on that's going to interrupt an art sale. So I'm really taking all of that into consideration. I love all of these kind of surrounding aspects of these real stories. So it's, you know, these real stories of the Tuba Fest, these real environments that we go into that become sort of like a satellite aspect of the narrative within the film, and all of those things combine in order to, you know, billow out into this much larger way of presenting narrative and experience. And so it can exist as sculpture. And so, for example, I have a show coming up at Art in General in March, and it's going to be presented at the Knockdown Center in Ridgewood, and it's a really massive space. And then I just had a solo show in France at also a very massive art center. And I've been thinking about how do you, you know, in these large rooms, how do you present multiple videos, you know, this constant experience that artists have when they're presenting video work in spaces that are not meant for sonic experiences and so often don't have very good acoustics. How do you play with that? And so lately I've been making these very large soundproofing quilts that are both formal, they're visually formal, and they're these, they engage a conversation about some of the original references that I gave to the composers to consider. So one of the composers I told, one of the composers is Christine Sun Kim, who's a deaf sound artist, and I asked her to look at many things, but one of them was pictures of Louise Nevelson's eyelashes. And it was sort of a random thing that I gave her and sort of just this thing I was thinking of sculpturally. And then what I've done is as I go into the shows, I reconsider some of those original references that I gave them. And so I've remade, for the show I did in France, I remade a Louise Nevelson piece as a soundproofing quilt. And so it was, we followed the whole sort of pattern of Louise Nevelson's piece, which looks a lot like soundproofing and also looks like a musical score. And then when I read into this one particular piece more, I found out that she was referencing open structure and jazz improvisation. So that was really lovely that I kind of hit on something musical and then built it out to be this functional soundproofing quilt. So
That is wonderful, and it's this kind of huge collaboration, and it sounds like these, though it may be different in March, these kind of iterations that you do, these different elements of it, are allowing viewers different access to your process and what you're doing, because so much of it really is about this process that you're going through, which is quite complex and with a lot of stories behind it.
Yeah, it's interesting because in some ways I feel like I'm just kind of sitting back and remaining very open. And sometimes I feel like the position that I take is almost like a musician working with other musicians in maybe a, you know, improv session, and just allowing myself to be really guided by the things that are kind of like touching my ears that I may be getting not all of, and then have to interpret the rest and compensate for what I'm not quite, you know. This is sort of maybe an extended metaphor, but I've been thinking about it lately, that this process of collaboration and this process of building is akin to me trying to compensate for the things that I'm aurally missing, and then really, really also attuning my sensitivity to all these little details that can become, you know, writers in the sort of larger story of the work.
That's exciting, and I look forward to your show in March. And is there other? I mean, what else do you do? This seems like something that's obviously not in the marketplace quite like other things, and is difficult to sell in other ways. So, are there a variety of activities you do to support your work? Does grant support it, or other jobs? How does that work?
Oh goodness, like that is. I mean, that's the background question that I'm constantly trying to figure out, as so many artists who work in similar ways as I do are. And so it's a big hodgepodge. I do have work right now that's in a group show at Five Car Garage in Los Angeles. And that is definitely, I mean, it definitely fits into a commercial context, even though it's actually these, they're long, narrow, vertical textile scores that are, there's these patterns on the scores that are made from Morse code representations of the names of the composers who worked on my film. So there's this kind of like cycling back conceptually into the work, but they're definitely objects that can be sold. And so I'm running these sort of parallel paths of making these they are very expensive film projects that are funded through grants, and then also making work that can be sold in a more commercial gallery context. And then when I get opportunities to work with somebody like, with a place like Art in General, that is a nonprofit space and presents this, you know, massive place to work in, I can work really big and do projects that wouldn't necessarily be easily sold. And then I also do adjunct teaching, and have been trying to figure out how to, you know, live off of grants and artist fees and blah blah blah, the game of the artist, I guess.
Yes, well, it sounds like you're playing it well, and it's very exciting to talk to you about this. I want to wish you well for your show in March, as well as the group show coming up. There'll be links to that in here. Is there anywhere else you want to guide listeners to before we close? There will be links in this interview to tell them where Art in General is and all of that. But anything else you want to mention before we close?
Let me think. I think that's it. I have kind of all my eyes and ears focused on the Art in General show right now, and.
Allison, I want to wish you luck on the Art in General show and everything in the future, and thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really
good.
Yeah,
thank you. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.